There's a sorry. Late 1800s, the second half of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, Eastern Europe, most professions were blocked as far as Jews were concerned. There were quotas on Jews completing high school, there were quotas on Jews entering college, there were all sorts of preventions that the governments made at that point in time, which were basically anti-Semitic reasons, in order that Jews shouldn't have a normal method of making a living. And basically, the prevalent Jewish profession at that point in time was peddling. Right? Jews became, by default, because they couldn't do anything else, they became peddlers. They bought in one place, traveled around the villages and sold, and the profit margin, that was what they lived on. But they also developed another profession which became a very popular Jewish profession and remains so by some people even to this very day, and that was smuggling. Smuggling became a very, very prevalent Jewish profession. There were products which in one country were cheaper than in another country, especially if there was a high tax on it. And if you could smuggle these goods from one side of the border to the other side of the border, you could make a huge profit. And Jews went into the smuggling business in a very big way. And basically the way it worked was that the Jews were the people who put up the financing. They had the money to buy the goods. They also had the contacts in the villages that they could sell the goods that they were smuggling in. But they weren't very good at the actual act of smuggling themselves across the borders, because they didn't know the different ways of getting across the border without being caught. So in order to get across the border, what you had to do was you had to make a deal with a non-Jew who was a wagon driver and who knew where the border guards were and who knew how to get across the border without being caught as you're crossing the border by the border police. So the various people who ran these smuggling rings had goyim that they worked with on a regular basis. These goyim had wagons. They used to hire the goy, pay him a large amount of money. In the middle of the night, he would take them across the border, knowing where to cross the border where there were no border guards. And they'd load up the wagon with the stuff that they were trying to smuggle, put the stuff on the wagon, and cross the border, come back into wherever it was, whether it was Poland, whether it was Galicia, whether it was Ukraine, whether it was Russia, whatever country it was, and sell the goods. The Briskarov, Zichron Livracha, used to tell the following story. He said there was a village, and this village was about 150 kilometers from the border. In this village, there lived a Jew, and this Jew ran a smuggling ring. This was his business. His business was he was a smuggler. He had a goy, and the goy had a wagon, and the goy knew all the pathways to get across the border to the other side without getting caught. And the goy regularly, every single Thursday night, used to rent the wagon with the driver. The driver used to drive him across the border. They'd load up with the goods. They'd come back before it got light on Friday morning, and then the following week the Jew would sell the smuggled goods. And this is the way the business went, week in, week out. The guy who had the wagon, he actually lived not far from the border. That's why he knew all the different ways of getting across the border, because he actually lived in the area there. The Jew lived 150 kilometers away. But part of the deal was that the guy would get his wagon Thursday afternoon, And he would travel for a few hours, pick the Jew up from the village, and then they'd both go together on the wagon till the border, cross the border in the middle of the night, pick up the goods, cross back over the border while it was still night, and the goy would bring the Jew back home with all the goods where the Jew had a place where he used to hide the goods that the customs people shouldn't find it. So the Briskerov said the following. The Briskerov said the Jew got on the wagon at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Thursday afternoon, and he started traveling the 3 or 4 hours that it took with the wagon to cover the distance to get up to the border. When the Jew left his house and said goodbye to his wife, he already started getting nervous. He knew he was running a risk. He's going to smuggle across the border. If he gets caught, he ends up in Siberia for the next 40 years of his life, if he survives Bichlal and doesn't get shot by the border guards. As they're traveling, the closer they get to the border, the more scared the Jew is. Right? As they get closer to the border, his heart starts beating faster, and he gets more and more nervous. But he's already nervous from the minute that he leaves his house. Says the Briskerov, what about the wagon driver? He says, the wagon driver is a guy. The wagon driver says to himself the following. Let's assume that they catch me. I'm definitely not going to get the same punishment as the Jew. First of all, they're anti-Semites, so they'll definitely give the Jew a bigger punishment than they'll give me. Number two, basically, what am I here? I'm just the driver. Because he's the smuggler, I'm the driver. So you can say aiding and abetting a crime. Right? It's a secondary type of crime, I've got less. So the first hour, the first 2 hours, the first 3 hours that they're driving through the border, the Balagola, the wagon driver, he's not nervous at all. However, when they get like an hour, three quarters of an hour, half away from the border, then even the guy who's driving the wagon starts getting nervous as well. Why? Because if we get caught, I am going to get some sort of punishment. Okay, they won't send me to Siberia for 30 years. They're not going to put me in front of a firing squad. But they are going to give me 10 years. So as they get closer to the border, he gets more and more nervous. Says Briskerov, what have you got here? You got a wagon, a horse, a goy, and a Jew. He says it's a very interesting phenomena. The Jew's already nervous when he leaves the house. The goy gets nervous when it's 45 minutes away from the border. The horse, he doesn't get nervous at all. The only calm component of the whole package is the horse. The horse doesn't get nervous when he leaves the house, the horse doesn't get nervous when he's on the way, and the horse doesn't get nervous when he crosses the border either. And the horse won't even get nervous when the border police start firing. Why? Because the horse hat nicht kein Seichel. Because the horse has got no Seichel, so he's got nothing to be nervous about. Says the Briskerov, in 20 odd hours, starts a Yom HaDin. Starts a Yom HaDin. A Yom HaDin, as Rabbi Lopin spoke about, which none of us can get out of. Because the Rebbe Shlom is going to be Yoshev Badin, and he's going to determine what happens to us over the next year. Whether we like it or not, that's going to happen. Down to the minutest detail. What's going to happen to us? What's going to happen to our families? What's going to happen to our friends? All revolving around us. So as the Briskerov, there are three types of Jews. There are Jews who get nervous already when they leave the house. He says there are Jews that get nervous when Slicha starts. There are some Jews who get nervous even before that. Rosh Chodesh Elul, when they hear the shofar blowing, they're already nervous. It's Yom HaDin. But most of us don't get nervous, let's face it, let's be honest. Most of us don't get nervous, Rosh Chodesh Elul. But when it starts, Slichus, then a Jew who thinks a little bit starts getting nervous. It's Yom HaDin. There is a second type of Jew, says the Briskerov. The second type of Jew is the type of Jews like the Balagola. He doesn't get nervous when Slicha starts. He only gets nervous as he's approaching the border. When it comes within the 24 hours before Rosh Hashanah, he starts getting nervous. Says the Briska Rav, if you don't get nervous at the beginning of Slichus, and you don't start getting nervous 24 hours before Rosh Hashanah, it's a raya, you're a field. It's a raya, you're a horse. Because only the horse doesn't get nervous. There's a Gemara in Yuma. The Gemara in Yuma tells over a story. So Gemara in Yuma, Daf Pei Zayin, Amud Aleph. The Gemara says the following story. Rav was the Gadol Ador. Rav was the Pesach Ador. Rav was the Gadol Ador. Rav was the man who was the Manig Ador. He ran the generation. He got into an argument with a butcher. There was a butcher who had a taina on Rav. The butcher felt that Rav had done something wrong to him. It wasn't true. Rav had passed him something about a cow that the butcher had, which the butcher didn't like, because the butcher lost money, because he said the cow was straight. Something happened there. He had this sichsuch with Rav, the butcher. The butcher did something to Rav, which was very, very, very not nice. We don't know what. But the butcher was chayta keneged Rav. He did something against Rav. Rav was sure that al kam Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, Aseres Yemei Tshuva, the butcher's going to come to him, and the butcher's going to ask him for mechila, and he'll be meichel the butcher, and everything will be fine. The Gemara says, Rav waited until Yom Kippur and the butcher never turned up. The butcher never came. It got to Erev Yom Kippur and Rav saw that the butcher wasn't turning up to ask him for mechila. Said, Rav, you know what? I'll go to the butcher. If I go to the butcher and the butcher sees me, then he'll remember that he was chaytik and eggly, and then he'll ask me for mechila, and I'll be mechlim, and I'll have a good Yom Kippur. So Rav went to the butcher. Says the Gemara, Rav turned round to Rav Huna and said to Rav Huna, I'm going to the butcher, you know, the butcher should ask me mechila that I can make peace with the butcher. I don't want that the butcher should go into Yom Kippur with this aveira that he was chaytik and agdi. I want that the butcher should ask me mechila that I can be meichlin, that he should have a good Yom Kippur. Says the Gemara, Rav Huna thought to himself, Rav's going to kill the butcher. Rav is going to be the cause that the butcher is going to drop dead. The butcher's not going to want to be Mephias Rav, and therefore the fact that the butcher was Pegeh but Rav is going to remain, and the butcher's going to get punished for it, and Rav's wasting his time, and if Rav goes to the butcher, he's going to cause that the butcher should die. He didn't say anything to Rav, he just thought this to himself. Says the Gemara, Rav got up, left his house, and he went to the butcher's store, where the butcher was standing. The Gemara says, when he walked into the butcher's store, the butcher had an axe in his hand, and he was chopping up the head of a calf. He just knocked the head off the calf, and he was in the middle of cutting up the head of the calf with a butcher's knife, or the butcher's axe, whatever it is. The butcher looked up from what he was doing, says the Gemara, and he saw Rav. Now, Rav, the Gemara calls him Rav, Rav meaning the God of Ador. That wasn't his real name. He had a name, but nobody called him by his name. Nobody ever went into Ramosha Feinstein, banged him on the back and said, Hi Mo, how are you doing? Huh? Nobody goes into a Chaim Kanievsky, knocks him on the back and says, "Hi Charlie, how's it doing today? London going all right?" So Rav was the same thing. People didn't call him by his name. His name was Abba. The butcher looked up, saw Rav standing there, and the butcher said, "Abba, get out of here. I don't want to have anything to do with you, and I don't want to have anything to do with the likes of you." Rashi explains that first of all he called him by his name, which was Derech Zilzul. That was in itself a Zilzul. And second of all, the expression that he said is also not very nice. "Get out of here, I don't want anything to do with you or with the likes of you." And he carried on chopping the head of the eagle. Says the Gemara, he just managed to get one more time that he hit the head of the eagle with the axe, and the axe hit a bone in the eagle's head, and the bone shattered into pieces, and one piece of the bone flew out of the eagle's head, and it went straight into the windpipe of the butcher. It hit him in the throat, and the butcher died on the spot. This story is very strange, because manashach, if the butcher deserved to die because the butcher was pegeya in Rav, then the butcher should have died the first time round when he was pegeya in Rav. Why is it that the butcher only died the second time he was pegeya in Rav? Second of all, Rav Huna was a Novi. How did Rav Huna know that Rav Huna should think to himself, "Oy vey, if Rav goes to the butcher, Rav's going to kill the butcher"? And how did Rav know that the second pegiya of the butcher is definitely going to kill the butcher, even if the first pegiya didn't? So Rabbi Tzvi Blaser brings this Gemara in his Sefer Kochvia, which I've quoted before, and he says, I'll explain to you what's going on here in the Gemara. He says there are two types of situation in which a person can be chayter, and they are two totally different types of situation. They bear no relationship one to the other. And because they bear no relationship one to the other, they have totally different types of reactions on the part of the Ribbono Shel Olam. There is a situation where a person is in a nisoyan, and he can't be, for whatever reason, Kovish Yesh Yitzroi. His Midasaray has come out. Somebody annoyed him, and his instinctive reaction to being annoyed is to be curious, is to be angry with the guy. We all know that very often somebody does something to us, and instinctively, it's not because we thought it through and we came to a decision that this is what we want to do, instinctively we curse him out. It's a Pavlovian reaction. Not because we made a cheshbon that this is what we should do in this given situation. It's because we're human beings and we react in certain ways. Those chatoim that a person does because his midas are misgaber olav, or because his yetzahara is misgaber olav, they don't tell you who the person really is. They're not an expression of the true personality of the person. We got him at a bad moment. We all of us use this expression, "He got up on the wrong side of the bed." You get up one morning and you get up in a bad mood. It happens to all of us. Anybody you meet that morning is going to get a mouthful from you. It doesn't make any difference, because you're in a bad mood. Does that mean that you are a bad person? No, that means you're a good person who, for whatever reason it may be, got up in a bad mood that morning. True, if you'd be a tzaddik yisrael, then you'd be able to control yourself the whole time. You'd always do what you're meant to do, but we're not tzaddikim. So sometimes we get up in a good mood, and sometimes we get up in a bad mood. That doesn't tell you who the person is. A guy gets angry, and the way he acts when he gets angry doesn't necessarily tell you who the person is. Because sometimes when a person gets angry, he loses control of what his true personality is. However, what happens if a person is totally calm? He got up on the right side in the morning. He's totally calm, he's in a great mood, everything's fine, no problems. And you walk by him, and you say good morning. Very nicely, very sweetly. You're a well-mannered person, you say good morning. And he curses you out, and he curses out your mother, and he curses out your father, and he curses out your grandmother, and he curses out your grandfather. And then he tries to attack you. Then you know that he hasn't consumed anything previously which should have caused him to react in that way. That tells you something about the person. There are such people. Every shul has one. Have you noticed that? It's one of the doctorates I'm going to write one day. Every shul has it. There's always a guy who sits in the corner, and you walk into shul Shabbos morning, and you say, "Good Shabbos, Mr. So-and-so," and he goes, "Who?" And if he's really in a great mood, he says, "Close the window." Every shtiebel has one. Every shtiebel has one. We all can think in our minds, we know the guy. We all know the guy. Right? You can't. If you come to this guy and he's in his deathbed, and he's dying, and you said to him, "Good morning," he'd say to you, "Ugh!" In a situation like that, it tells you something about the person. The first time that the butcher was pegeya in Rav, we could be down the kav schus. We could say, you know what? Yitzra is Gabrielov. He couldn't control his anger. He didn't think that he was being pegeya in Rav. He came in with a shayla. He just invested a fortune of money in a cow. They shechted the cow, and now Rav says to him, the cow is... trade. He just lost a fortune of money, so his instinctive reaction is, anyway, and who is he? Who does he think he is? It doesn't tell you anything. He's upset, right? He just got wiped out, basically. But when Rav comes to him on Erev Yom Kippur, Rav comes to him, where he's already long forgotten the story that happened, and he's calm, cool, and collected, and he's just standing there by himself in his shop preparing his meat for Sukkot, for the women who are going to come there at Sukkot. And he curses out Rav. It's a time when he's calm, when it's Yeshiva Das, and he's cursing out Rav. That tells you something about the guy. That tells you that he is Mevazeh Talmidei Chachomim. That's his nature, that's his personality, that's who he is. That he's Mevazeh the Torah that Rav represents. But that's not the end of it. It's even more than that. He didn't go to Rav. Rav came to him. Here you've got a situation. The Rav's coming to the butcher. And Rav's presenting himself to the butcher. Rav's trying to be Makarov himself to the butcher. And basically what Rav is saying when he walks in through the door, and this was the idea that Rav was trying to get across to the butcher. Here I am. All you have to do is to say one sentence. One sentence. Just tell me one sentence and everything will be fine. Just say to me, Rabbi. Remember the story that happened? You have to understand, I was in a bad mood that day. I didn't really mean it. I apologize. And instead, what does the butcher do? He curses him out a second time. In other words,
Reb Moshe Feinstein turned up. Well, I have the Reb Chaim L'Chaim. Reb Chaim Konevsky turns up by your door. All you have to say to him is, I'm sorry. And you curse him out and throw him out. I don't have anything to do with you. I don't have anything to do with anybody like you. Says Reb Yitzchak Blaser, so if so, then Lichura, Rav Huna was right, Rav shouldn't have gone to the butcher. So where did Rav get it from? But no, even though there is the off chance that it's going to end up killing the butcher, he has to go to the butcher.
Says Rabbi Yitzchak Blaser, Rav got it from the Ribbono Shel Olam. How did he get it from the Ribbono Shel Olam? Because the Ribbono Shel Olam does exactly the same thing. The Rambam writes in Perek Beis in Hilchos Tshuva Halacha Vov, Afal Pisha Tshuva V'Atzaka Yofel Le'olam. Even though a person can do tshuva any day of the year, and he can daven to the Ribbono Shel Olam to be meichel him any day of the year. The Asara Yomim, in those 10 days, which start with Rosh Hashanah and which finish with Yom Kippur, Hu Yofer B'Yosa, those are the best days to do tshuva. Umiskabeles, and the Ribbono Shel Olam will miyad immediately accept your tshuva. Shenema, because the pasuk says Dirshu Hashem Behi Yosei Korov. The Ribbono Shel Olam is coming to us in the Aseres Yemei Tshuva. Comes any day in the year you can do tshuva. But that's not where our minds are at. Let's be honest. Our minds aren't at tshuva and at the Ribbono Shel Olam most days of the year. If our minds would be with the Ribbono Shel Olam with tshuva most days of the year, then we wouldn't act the way that we act most days of the year. So in Mela, the days of the year, the Ribbono Shel Olam really can't come to us with a taina that we're not doing what we're meant to be doing, we're not acting properly. Because we always have the answer that we can turn around to the Ribbono Shel Olam and we can say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, as the Gemara says in Brachos, Ritzeinenu la'aseis ritzoncha, we would like to do what you want. But as Sa'el should be Easter, we should be Malchus Makvin. Life is life. We haven't got time to think about Ribbono Shel Olam. We're too busy with other things. But when it comes from tomorrow night until Yom Kippur, there we already have a problem. Because there, we don't have to go to the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Ribbono Shel Olam came to us. He turned up in the store. From tomorrow night, when we start Ma'ariv until basically Hoshana Rabbah, the Ribbono Shel Olam is standing by us. We don't have to go to him. And he's waiting. And he's waiting and he's saying to himself the following, you know what? Kam Yochel. You did certain things. Yeah, okay. You throw Miss Gabra alone, me do yourself Miss Gabra alone. Fine. I understand it. But I'm giving you now a period of time when I'm coming to you and I'm saying to you, okay, now be calm. Now think. Who are you? Tell me who you are. And according to the way in which you behave, I will define who you are and accordingly I will relate to you. That's what the Aseres Yemei Tshuva are all about. That's what Rosh Hashanah is about. That's what Yom Kippur is about. That goes right through Tzukas until Hoshana Rabbah. But basically the Ribbono Shel Olam is saying to us, who are you? Tell me who you really are. How you act the rest of the year doesn't really worry me. And it doesn't really worry me that I know that there are going to be things the rest of the year where me teich kas, where me teich lachatz, where me, for all variety of reasons, you're not going to do the right thing. Because, man, I'm standing in the store, and we've got a period of time which is a calm period of time, it's a period of time devoted to one thing and one thing only, Ribbono Shel Olam, now I'll be able to tell who you really are. And according to the way in which you act in this period of time, that's how I will have to determine. Mi yichye u mi yomus. I just want to say one thing. I don't want to get into the philosophy. Perhaps we'll talk about it on another occasion. But we believe the Emunah Shleima, the basic tenet of Judaism, that the world runs b'hashgacha pratis, v'hakol bidei shamayim, and whatever happens, happens because the Rebbeinu Shlomo wants it to happen. However, the Gemara says, hakol bidei shamayim, everything happens because the Rebbeinu Shlomo wants it to happen. But the Jew has bechira over one thing. Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyiras shamayim. Yiras shamayim, that's a choice that we have. What does this expression yiras shamayim mean? What does it mean, yiras shamayim? It's words. What is the practical understanding of yiras shamayim? When can you say that a person is a yirei shamayim, and when is he not yirei shamayim? So I was thinking today, and I think it's a chiddush, but I think it's emes. I think so. I can't guarantee you, but I think so. There's a pasuk in the Torah, and the pasuk in the Torah says the following. The pasuk in the Torah says that Avraham Avinu was given a number of nisyonos, was tested by the Ribono Shel'olam. The final test, the culmination of all the nisyonos, is what the Kriyas HaTorah that we read on Rosh Hashanah. That's the parsha of the Akedah. And when the Ribono Shel'olam turns round to Avraham Avinu, after the Akedah, when Avraham Avinu is willing to sacrifice his son, and the Rebbeinu Shalom stops him at the last moment, what does the Rebbeinu Shalom say to Avraham Avinu? We're going to read it in the parsha. Ato yodaiti ki yirei elikim ato. Now I know that you're yirei elikim. Avraham Avinu went through 9 nisyonos, and the Rebbeinu Shalom doesn't know whether he's yirei elikim. He doesn't know. Now all of a sudden I know that you're yirei elikim. Why? Because you wanted to kill somebody, your own son. So I think that the pshat is poshut. What is the most difficult dilemma that a person lives in, which stops him from changing? We all build for ourselves a certain image. We choose to build the image. We choose to build the image because of a variety of reasons. And each guy has his own image. This guy is a cool guy, and this guy believes that he's got gift to music, and this guy believes that he's God's gift to good looks, and this guy believes that he's God's gift to the female race. Everybody builds an image about himself. And then you've got the guy who really thinks that he's a philosopher, and he's a thinker, and he's got deus, and he knows what's wrong with the from community, and he knows what's wrong with this, and he knows what's wrong with that, and he knows everything. Right? Chazal call him a Balgaiva, but he thinks he's a philosopher. Right? Everybody's building for himself an image. And the way in which we act, day in, day out, is to constantly feed this image. We are mechuyev to act in a certain way because that's the image we built for ourselves, and therefore if we don't act in this way, it's destroying the image that we're trying to project. So if I'm a cool guy, you can't expect me to do X, because cool guys don't do X. And if the image I'm trying to build is that I'm the greatest thinker, then you can't expect me to do this, because thinkers don't do this. And if I believe that I'm God's gift to the female race, then you can't blame me for looking, dressing, and acting like a homosexual. Because all I'm thinking about is to be a female. And everything we do is always going to be in that, following that theme.
That's the mitzvah. That's the way we're going to act. The most difficult dilemma that faces a person is to do something knowing that if he gets up and he does it, all his peers, whether they say it to him in his face or they don't, are going to say, "Whoa, what happened to him? Ooh. Give one of the grace of Tzaddik, huh?" That's basically what stops us from changing. The fear that somebody's going to look at us and say to us, "You? Davening? You? Learning?" It's like the guy who tries to stop talking Lashon Hara. "Who do you think you are? You're not talking Lashon Hara." It's difficult. It's difficult for a person to all of a sudden one day get up one morning and say, "You know what? I've been living in a mistake for the last who knows how long." I had an uncle who spent 28 years in Siberia, in the labor camp. He got arrested for teaching in a yeshiva, and he spent 28 years in the labor camp. He told me the following. He said, "He said, forget about the physical problems. Forget about the fact that they nearly died there. Forget about the cruelty. He says, forget about everything else. He says, you know what really disturbed me there? He says, people who were put away by Stalin, they were put in front of a firing squad by Stalin, and the last thing they said before they were shot was, 'Long live Stalin.'" He said, "Why? Because if they would say something else, then they had to admit that 50 years of their lives they were living in a mistake. Nobody wants to do that." He said he had a guy in the same bunk as him who was shot in the firing squad, a Jew, who used to argue with him and say to him, "You should be here. You should be here because you're a Trotsky-Leninist deviationist. That's why you should be here. I'm here because Stalin doesn't know I'm here. It's a mistake. The minute he finds out, they'll let me out." Because nobody wants to admit that they had it wrong the whole time. Avraham Avinu ran around the world talking about what? The godless Abayir, the chesed of the Abayir, everything. The Avdei Avinu Zorah, the Melech, that's treif. That's a lie. Monotheism, Ribbono Shel Olam, that's the emes. And then the Ribbono Shel Olam says to him, "Okay, now do what? Go and do something that goes against everything you have been projecting over your entire life. You've been running around since the age of 3 telling everybody, 'Ribbono Shel Olam, Ribbono Shel Olam, Ribbono Shel Olam,' and Melech offering up your kids as korbanos. That's Aveda Zora. Now go and offer up your kid as a korban." And Ribbono says, "Okay." Says Ribbono Shel Olam, "Ato yore, ato. Now I know the Yireli Kimata. That's Yireli. Hakel b'day shemayim. Everything's hashgacha, but there's one decision that a person has to make on his own. The Ribbono Shel Olam can't make it for him, and that's, do I have the guts to be able to change, even though the peer pressure is such that it's very difficult for a person to change?" And I want to finish up with one thought. Rosh Hashanah is Yom Adin. You'd think, if Rosh Hashanah is Yom Adin, how does a person do tshuva? So the Rambam says, you do tshuva, there's a process. There's charot ala ofra, there's kabbalah ala osi, there's vidui. Do we say al chait on Rosh Hashanah? No. We don't say al chait on Rosh Hashanah, we don't say vidui on Rosh Hashanah. There are some people, Mr. Harim, Mr. Sfar, some days, don't even say avinu malkeinu chatanu b'fanecha. They start from the second one. And we don't eat a goizim on Rosh Hashanah, because if you spell chet wrongly, it comes out to be the gematria of a goizim. Right? Well, we don't want to talk about chet on Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is the Yom HaDin. Rosh Hashanah is the day in which we're asking mechila for our chatoim. So I was thinking the following. You have a building. You want to knock down the building.
So basically, you've got two ways of knocking down the building. You can push it, pull it apart. You can start on the top, take down the top row of bricks, then take down the second row of bricks, then take down, and work your way slowly, taking down pieces, 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 pieces. And eventually, you've got no building. But what if the building was built 100 years ago like they used to build buildings? And you try and take it apart brick by brick, what's going to happen? It's going to take you 1,000 years to knock down this building. So what's the fastest way of getting the building down? Well, every building is based on what? Foundations. If you blow up the foundations, what's going to happen? The building's going to collapse. So you put down dynamite and you blow the foundations and the building implodes, right? And it's done the whole time. Here in Israel, that's the way they knock down buildings the whole time. They didn't control the explosions. They knock down and implode the building. Knocks down the building. If you're talking about a building which wasn't built, so you talk about Chatoim Lach. Little Chatoim, you know? Yeah, no, it's there. No problem. Knock this out, knock that out, take a brick out, put another one in. No problem. And what do you talk, what do you do when it's like us? When the whole building's rotten through and through. You gotta knock down the whole building, what do you do? You put dynamite in the foundation, explode the whole thing and start all over again. Vidui, Charota, Kapora. That's all when you're talking about the guy who basically is a tzaddik and he's got a few things that he did wrong during the year. Says the Rambam, no problem, you know what? Maybe between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, a guy will do one or two kleinos. He won't be mechaven in Kriya Shema the way he should have been. So they'll say, I'll chait on Yom Kippur. That'll help him. But if the whole Matzias is wrong, if the whole approach is wrong, if the whole world outlook is wrong, you have to explode the building. You have to start from scratch. That's what Rosh Hashanah is about. There's no chait of Rosh Hashanah, there's no charot ala, there's no kabbalah ala asid. Rosh Hashanah is making a decision. Am I a Yireh Elikim or am I not a Yireh Elikim? Am I? Or am I not? And what is the Ribbono Shelolam waiting for? Ribbono Shelolam is waiting for the decision, and Ribbono Shelolam says that as long as you call me, I'm there. I'm near. I'm close. I'm going to be close now for a period of a couple of weeks. What you did in the past doesn't worry me. I'm worried for you. That was mitech kaf, that was mitech midas, that was mitech all sorts of things. But now you've got no excuse. Now I want to see who you really are. That's the Aveda, that's what we have to do from tonight, Be'etzim. From Erev Rosh Hashanah. The Rebbeinu Shlomo is looking at us, he wants to see what our davening is like, he wants to see what our learning is like, he wants to see what and when. He wants to see what we look like on Rosh Hashanah. How do we daven in Rosh Hashanah? And on the basis of that, he's going to decide how the new year is. There doesn't exist a guy in this room. And I'm not even going so far as Rabbi Lopium to talk about whether your marriages are going to be happy marriages or aren't happy marriages. He's an optimist, I'm a pessimist, so I've already made my decision on that. That's not the issue. I hope the issue is much more basic. There doesn't exist anybody sitting in this room at this point in time who doesn't know somebody in his immediate family who hasn't got problems. There are people who had businesses for years and years and years. Second generation businesses, third generation businesses. That disappeared overnight. There are machlas. There are sicknesses, Rahman al-Islam. There are other problems. Everybody, there's nobody in this room who hasn't got somebody in the family who hasn't got problems. And it's our davening that makes the difference. Because the Rambam says, Mefurish, you don't, it's not only you who gets judged. It's you and the society you live in and the family you live in, and you can be the one that's making the whole difference. And we've got a couple of weeks in which the Ribbono Shelolam says, take me seriously for a change. I'm here. Korev Hashem l'chol Korev says rebellion is true. The Ribbono Shelolam is near anybody who wants to call out to him. But with one condition. L'chol Hashem k'ruhu be'emes. There has to be a certain sincerity involved. There has to be a certain seriousness involved. There has to be a certain different type of behavior for a couple of weeks. And if we do that, then the Rabbeinu Shalom promises us that Tichle Shonim Kilo Yisrael, the year with all its curses, and there were so many klolas befat from the klol. It was a horrible year for Klal Yisrael. And it still is a dangerous year for Klal Yisrael. You guys are living in your own cuckoo land. You don't realize what's going on here. You don't realize that Klal Yisrael, particularly here in Eretz Yisrael, is in a matter which hasn't been for whom the last 100 years. It's a matter of a sakona which is unbelievable what's going on here. There's anti-Semitism in the world today that there hasn't been since the Second World War. All over the world, including the great free democratic Medina Sachesed. And the Rebbeinu Shalom overnight, right, put a little Hitler in there and everything's changed. A little black Hitler as well. May my liberal Jewish friends excuse me. In private lives, in families, what's going on? Tichle shonim kereseo, tochu shonim brochu seo, mishlevet sivot simitetet.